with some of these strange laws that seem strange to us, on clean and unclean. And I say clean and unclean part one because chapters 13 through 15 continue this whole discussion that we have on this idea of cleanliness. One of the connections from the previous sections we've looked at, remember that the first 17 chapters are talking about how we can approach God, and the first seven chapters talk specifically about the kinds of offerings that have to be given. Now, chapters 8 through 17 give you scenarios or examples of these offerings being given. So, for example, in chapters 8, 9, and 10, what were some of the offerings that were given that we read about in the first seven chapters? Yeah, okay, burnt offering, sin offering. So, we read about how to do these things in the first seven chapters. Chapters 11 through 17 are going to give you more examples of times where some of these offerings are going to be required. You're not going to see any offerings in chapter 11, but it's going to ramp up when we talk about this cleanliness idea, the clean and unclean. It's going to ramp up to talking about sacrifices that are required, depending on your level of uncleanness and how you became unclean and things of that nature. Okay, how long did it take to receive the instructions from Leviticus? How long were they receiving these instructions? Yeah, over the course of 1 month. And I still have, some of you actually asked for a printout of these passages so you can actually read them. And I still haven't done that for you, so I'm sorry about that. But it's in Exodus 40, verse 17, and then Numbers chapter 1, verse 1, when you see the book ending of those passages, you see that Leviticus takes place over the course of 1 month. And so, how many stories are there in the book of Leviticus? Two. And each story corresponds to the overall section in which it's found. So, in the section on the way to God, how do we approach Him, you've got Nadab and Abihu not approaching God properly. And then, when it talks about the walk with God, so after we've approached Him and we're in communion with Him, now how does our daily life look? Well, the second story is about a kid. It says a son. You wouldn't stone a kid until they were how old? Anybody know?
Eight.
Not eight.
No, it's older. They were like 20 or something. No?
It was younger than that. It's after their bar mitzvah. So when I was first reading the Old Testament laws when I was a new Christian, and I saw like if a kid curses his mother and father, then he's supposed to be put to death. I was like, well, how did any of those toddlers survive? But what does the word bar mean? Like Simon bar Jonah? Son of. What's mitzvah? Bar mitzvah. What's a mitzvah? It's law. It's another term for the law. So bar mitzvah means son of the law. And you become culpable under the law when you were 12 or 13. And so that's what a bar mitzvah is. And once you had that rite or that ritual, that's when you would be stoned. And so whenever you read about children or sons or daughters being stoned in the Old Testament, that would not apply to a kid until they were 12 or 13. So it's not a little kid, in other words. Okay, so, but that is dealing with a kid's speech, which is in the context of the section about your walk with God, your daily living. And so this book is structured much like Romans or Ephesians or Colossians, where it begins by talking about the provisions God has made so that we can have communion with Him. And then the second half of the book is our response to His goodness towards us. Now, one of the things that we pointed out about Leviticus so far is that we might look at these laws as being burdensome, but the original audience would not have looked at them as being burdensome. How exciting would that have been for them to be able to be in communion with the God who just moved in next door? And so these laws are helping them know how to draw near to God. Would anybody with a good heart want to know how to draw near to God? And would such commands seem burdensome? Not at all. And so that's one important thing, I think, to know about this book as we study it. Alright, so to introduce what we're looking at this morning, this is, as we said, a new section dealing with clean and unclean. And chapter 11, this breaks up in a couple different ways. There's two different ways that you can subdivide these chapters in 11 through 15. So chapter 11 is going to talk about being clean or unclean regarding food. And then chapters 12 through 15 will deal with clean and uncleanness with regards to the body. So in chapter 12, the body giving birth. Chapters 13 and 14, the body with skin diseases. And then chapter 15, bodily discharges. So you've got food, and then you've got things connected and associated with the body. What does it mean to be clean or unclean? We've talked about this a little bit so far.
In a sense, pure or impure.
Yeah, pure or impure. What was the practical effect of it? Yeah, Everett?
If you were clean, you could offer sacrifices. If you were not, you couldn't.
That's right. So if you were clean, you could go to the tabernacle. And you could bring a sacrifice and touch the sacrifice because you have to lay your hand on it and all this different kind of stuff. If you were unclean, you were not necessarily in sin, but you simply couldn't go to the tabernacle. And now, we'll talk about some of the reasons for that as we go through this. So that's one way to outline chapters 11 through 15, is clean and uncleanness with regards to food, and then also the body. But there's another way that you can outline these chapters, and that's with the increasing duration of uncleanness that we read about. So, for example, if you become unclean by some kind of unclean animal, if it was a dietary concern, you were only unclean for several hours. And we'll see how that works in just a moment. If you were unclean after having given birth, you would have been either weeks or months of being unclean. And we'll talk about that chapter in just a moment. Chapters 13 and 14 deal with skin diseases, which possibly could be years of uncleanness. And then in chapter 15, where it talks about bodily discharges, those things are variable, where it depends on what kind of discharge we're talking about, and there's different levels of uncleanness that we'll see in some of these sections. But this is like an ongoing thing. You're always going to have bodily discharges. And so you see kind of an increasing kind of sense of the duration that we're reading about in these chapters. Does that make sense? Any comments or questions about that? Now, as we go through these chapters, God has given us the Bible and everything in the Bible for reasons, and that therefore we should study everything that the Bible has to say. So, the outline of what we're looking at today, clean and unclean food, or clean and unclean animals, and then clean and unclean after childbirth. Anything else anybody wants to say just by way of introduction before we start looking at chapter 11? All right. Let's look at chapter 11, and I'll go ahead and read verses 1 through 8. We're not going to read this whole chapter, but I want to get at least started with the first 8 verses here. And the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, saying to them, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, these are the living things that you may eat among all the animals that are on the earth. Whatever parts the hoof and is cloven-footed and chews the cud, among the animals you may eat. Nevertheless, among those that chew the cud or part the hoof, you shall not eat these. The camel, because it chews the cud, but does not part the hoof, is unclean to you. The rock badger," anybody ever been tempted to have one of those? "Because it chews the cud, but does not part the hoof, is unclean to you. And the hare, because it chews the cud, but does not part the hoof, is unclean to you. And the pig, because it parts the hoof and is cloven-footed, but does not chew the cud, is unclean to you. You shall not eat any of their flesh, and you shall not touch their carcass. They are unclean to you." Okay. So, you notice that in verse 1 how this begins here. I'm sorry, that font is a little smaller than I anticipated it being. Alright, so the who is addressed in verse 1?
Moses.
And Aaron. This does not happen in every chapter. Here God is addressing Moses and Aaron. What would be the rationale for addressing both of them? Yes. What were the priests told to do in chapter 11, or chapter 10? After Nadab and Abihu, they were told to distinguish between what? The clean and the unclean. And so if this section begins a new portion of Leviticus that's telling them, here's how you distinguish the clean and unclean, you need to disseminate this information to Moses and Aaron, because Aaron is supposed to let the priests know this so that they can tell the congregation. And maybe one thing to say about this is that our job as God's priests today is to help people know the binariness, if that's a word, of what's clean and unclean. And we'll say more about that as we go through this. But it's addressed to both of them. Now, you've got the classification of animals here, and you're going to see different classes of animals. There's going to be land animals, there's going to be sea animals, there's going to be birds, winged insects. Let's start out by talking about these land animals. By the way, this idea of clean and unclean animals, did that distinction exist prior to Leviticus? Yeah, how do we know? Yeah, Noah. In Genesis 7, after Noah's supposed to bring clean animals onto the ark, extra pairs of them for the sacrifices, things like that. And so, one thing, do you think that these classifications of clean and unclean animals in Leviticus 11 would have been the same classification from Genesis 7?
God doesn't change. So, I mean, would we be assuming one way or the other?
Yeah. I'm seeing more heads saying yes than no. That's what I think too. But how would we know that? And for that matter, when Abraham is going to offer up his son Isaac as a burnt offering, was he going to follow the same protocols as Leviticus 1? And how would we know? What was that? Yeah, but the Genesis 22 account is we have that before Leviticus. So how do we know what ritual Abraham was going to do? Aaron?
If he's telling them here and giving the distinction, do you not think he would have told Noah this? And he called the animals. He was the one who called the animals to come to the ark. So he already divided.
So here's how I think through this. There are places in the Bible where it talks about the law singular of Moses. I don't remember the passages right now. I know one of them is in 1st or 2nd Chronicles. But it talks about the law of Moses, which includes which books of the Bible? The first, how many? 5. And it's referred to as a single volume. The Bible itself refers to it as a single volume. And so if it's supposed to be read as like there's really only 5 chapters to what Moses wrote, and the first chapter is Genesis, and the second chapter is Exodus, so on and so forth, that what is said in one part informs an earlier part. So I think you're supposed to see these as the same distinctions, but now they're being codified. And that's how, I think that's the easiest way to understand that when we understand that this is a document that Moses wrote, and it has 5 chapters. And so now we have the codification of them. All right, so the land animals, what were they allowed to eat? Yeah, divided hoof. What does it mean to chew the cud? Yeah, the regurgitating thing with the multiple chambers in the stomach. And what else? What does it mean it's eating?
Grass,
right? All right, so they got to know how to identify different animals. God's giving them categories, not just a list of what they can and can't eat, although he does list some things out. But he starts with the dividing of it. What's forbidden?
Camels.
What was that?
Camels and the rock badger.
Yeah, so he's going to list out some of them, but what's the criteria? Like, if you... Anything that doesn't have both criteria of the divided hoof and choose the cud. Now, what I want to do right now is we're going to go through these instructions, and then I want to come back and analyze why God may have given these laws. But I just want us to, first of all, see the painting. Like, why? Let's see what the text is saying. All right, so those are the instructions for the land animals. Now, what would make you unclean with regards to these animals? How would you become unclean in association with them in verse 8?
Even touch.
Touch what? The carcass. All right, so if you touch the carcass of the animal, what's the other way that you could become unclean? Eating them. And so if you happened upon a carcass and you were just really tempted to touch the dead rock badger, you better not do it. But does this mean that you could touch a unclean animal that was alive?
Yes.
Was there any prophets that were fed by an unclean bird?
Yeah,
the raven, right? Elijah was fed by the raven when he was in the brook. What animal would you want to ride that you couldn't eat?
A camel.
A camel, what else?
A donkey.
An elephant. a horse. So, this is important to know about the clean and unclean animals. If you wanted to ride on a horse, you could ride on a horse. You just couldn't eat it. So that's the idea. Or if it was dead, don't touch the dead corpse of it. All right, so those are the instructions for the land animals. For the sea creatures, the criteria for them is that it had to have fins and it had to have scales. But if it didn't have either, then you couldn't eat them. Now, what would be some detestable sea creatures today? Oh, for the nation of Israel.
Lobster,
so red lobster, you can't go there.
All the shellfish.
Yeah, the shellfish, a lot of good seafood that they couldn't eat. What?
Shrimp.
Yeah, no shrimp. It doesn't have the fins and the scales, and so he's giving them those instructions there. The birds in verses 13 through 19. By the way, I have the cross-references to Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 14 is the other chapter in the Old Testament that gives the instructions for clean and unclean food. The Deuteronomy 14 account for the birds is more positive. Here in 13 through 19, it just gives a list of birds you can't eat. But in Deuteronomy 14, it gives you some examples of ones that you can eat. In Hebrew, some of the hardest words to translate are animal words. So there's going to be a lot of differences in translations here. And some of the words are found only here in the whole Bible. And so one of the things to say about the birds that are listed is that many of them are predators. And that's maybe some degree of commonality you can find to try to categorize them. So that those are the ones for the birds. And then you've got the winged insects. Look at. Let's go ahead and read this one. Look at verses 20 to 23. All winged insects that go on all four are detestable to you. Yet among the winged insects that go on all fours, you may eat those that have jointed legs above their feet, with which to hop on the ground. Of them you may eat the locust of any kind, the bald locust of any kind, the cricket of any kind, and the grasshopper of any kind. But all other winged insects that have 4 feet are detestable to you. Okay. What's acceptable here?
You have to have jointed legs.
Yeah, so it's got to be the kind of things that if you're trying to catch it, it can jump away from you, rather than the ones that you just simply smush because they're just trying to scatter away. Who in the Bible ate locusts? John the Baptist. Any idea on why the Bible seems to give us that detail? Why do we need to know what John the Baptist ate?
Do we know it was the insect? Because there's a plant, there's a tree that bears pods. Are also locusts. So. But anyhow.
I'm not sure about that.
I don't want to spoil your point, but I read that.
Well, now my point is spoiled. So why would John the Baptist be eating locusts?
He's out in the wilderness.
What is that?
Where he's living.
Yeah, he's living in the wilderness. Is there any connection in the Bible between what a prophet eats and how it corresponds to his message? Do you remember Ezekiel? What is Ezekiel told to eat? The scroll, and what is it like in his mouth?
Sweet.
Sweet, and what is it like in his tummy?
Bitter.
Why? Because what he's going to be preaching to the people is sweet for those who repent and listen, but it's going to be bitter for those who reject it. So when John the Baptist is eating locusts, what are locusts used for in the Bible? Is it a clean animal, by the way? Yeah, a bug, you can eat it. But what are locusts used for in the Bible?
For plagues.
In the book of Joel, it's used. It's one of the 10 plagues. So for John the Baptist to be eating locusts, yeah, he's the forerunner for King Jesus, and it's indicating that whatever is true about the forerunner is going to have some things to say about Jesus. He's not eating all the fine things of the world. This is not a kingdom of the world. That's one of the points to make from that. But I think it also harkens back to some of those ideas of Ezekiel. Even the prophet John in the book of Revelation eats a scroll, and then that corresponds to his message. And so John the Baptist, he's eating locusts and wild honey. Locust, because there's going to be judgment, the baptism of fire. But there's also honey, the baptism of the Holy Spirit that he's preaching about. And so his message corresponds in both of those ways. And so that's one of those bugs or those critters that jumps. Crickets would be the same kind of thing. Were you going to say something? I've been seeing on the news that people are talking about eating the cicadas whenever they finally come out. I don't think that would have constituted that. Some cultures eat bugs, and so that's one of the examples of that. What would not be accepted for the winged insects?
Flies.
What's the category, though?
That crawl.
Anything that crawls on the floor. Like, that has four, like, can't really jump or anything like that? Yeah. Yeah, ants would certainly be one that you don't want to eat. Centipedes. Those things that we're normally tempted to eat. I'm sorry, but you can't. Some of this almost kind of seems like common sense. Like, well, yeah, if I had to eat bugs, it certainly wouldn't be the ones that crawl. Like, I feel like that kind of fits my instincts. If I had to eat bugs, I guess I would eat a cricket more so than a centipede. But this is how God is laying this out for them. All right, any comments or questions up through verse 23?
Well, you convinced me that it was insects you would
eat. I convinced you? All right, good. Good. Because my point was just so good, right, that it has to be true.
Well, and I think it's logical, really. But I'm going to look up some more stuff on it. Just
I've never heard of the locust plant.
There's a locust it's edible. But
yeah. Yeah, but if you find anything out on that, let me know.
Okay, but I think your point is exactly correct.
All right. Okay, of all of these animals, which one becomes the most taboo that you can't eat? The pig. Why the pig? What of all the animals here, like, why do you think the pig becomes the biggest, most memorable taboo, don't eat that one?
They wallow in the mud and they'll eat anything.
Okay, but what about eating a donkey or a camel or like a horse? Like, why wasn't that the thing that like becomes the biggest like taboo? Don't eat that one.
Carry bacteria.
Because everybody else eats pigs. Like, of all the animals that are listed here, which one was most commonly eaten in the ancient world? Do you think there's a bunch of people wanting to go for centipedes? And, like, that's why, you know, you don't read about that being the big taboo one, don't eat the centipedes. They bite anyways, and the bite hurt really bad. I got bitten by one last year. So Robert Alter is an atheist who has written a brilliant commentary on the Old Testament. It's just phenomenal. And he said this about this text. He says, interestingly, in the high country in the eastern part of Canaan, where Israelite population was concentrated toward the end of the second millennium BCE, the percentage of pig bones discovered is only a fraction of what it is in the Canaanite lowlands. So here's an atheist saying this, that when archaeologists have done digs and stuff like this, and they go into the territory where the Israelites would have lived, the amount of pig bones that you find are very few. But when you go to the areas that the Canaanites lived in, suddenly you find a bunch of them. Which goes back to what Clara was saying, that the pigs would have been commonly eaten, and the Israelites were not. Now, this gives us a hint that we'll talk more about in just a moment on why these laws might have been given. But we'll talk about that in just a second. Okay, so those are just the clean and unclean. There's a couple things to say then about, okay, what if you become impure by contacting the carcass or eating one of these or something like that. Look at verses 24 to 28, and we'll just read this section here, and it'll set us up for the rest of this portion. Look at 24 to 28. And by these you shall become unclean. Whoever touches their carcass shall be unclean, and here's the first time we see this, until the evening. That phrase is going to be used a bunch here. And whoever carries any part of their carcass shall wash their clothes and be unclean until the evening. Every animal that parts the hoof, but is not cloven-footed, or does not chew the cud, is unclean to you. Everyone who touches them shall be unclean, and all that walk on their paws among them, that means cats and dogs, them included there, the animals that should go on all fours are unclean to you. Whoever touches their carcass shall be unclean until the evening, and whoever carries their carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. They are unclean to you. Okay. So, from this passage, we already talked about this a little bit, but how do you become unclean? By touching a carcass, by carrying a carcass. So then here's the question. How do you become clean?
Wash.
You wash? What? What do you wash?
Clothes.
Your clothes, and what else? Well, beyond the washing, then what do you have to do?
Wait.
You have to wait till evening. Notice that for this kind of impurity, there's no offerings. There's only washing of your clothes, and then you wait till evening. And this business of waiting till evening is repeated a bunch of times. And so that's the instruction for clean and unclean food in that regard. You got the same thing applied to the swarming creatures. Have you ever wondered, biblically speaking, what are the swarming creatures? So, verses 29 to 31 give us examples of what this means. Look at verses 29 to 31. And these are unclean to you among the swarming things that swarm on the ground. The mole rat, the mouse, the great lizard of any kind, the gecko, the monitor lizard, the lizard, the sand lizard, and the chameleon. These are unclean to you among all that swarm. Whatever touches them when they are dead shall be unclean until the evening. So what are the swarming things? What was that?
Bees?
Yeah. Lizards. Yeah, lizards. Like, things that kind of, like, swarm. Like they scatter. Like, when you open the door or whatever. So those are the examples given in 29 to 31.
I've never seen lizards swarm like that. I've seen bees do it.
Well, this is how God defines it. Like, they're swarming across the land or whatever. Yeah.
Mine calls it creeping things.
Creeping things?
Creeping things.
Swarming things. So my version says swarming things. Some say creeping things. What is it in the UK right now? There's a mouse. There's a problem with mouse and rats that happens every so many years. Have you guys heard about this in the news? Where they're being overloaded in Great Britain or the UK somewhere with all kinds of rats everywhere. And they're just kind of swarming all over the land. Like in the Indiana Jones movie, maybe. How might you contact a dead lizard? Yeah, you step on. Anybody ever? Are there lizards in Georgia? There are. What kind? Oh, like the skinks, like the kind that lose their tails and stuff. There's geckos here. Really? I haven't seen any.
I have one in my house the other day, so I know they're here.
Okay, well, so in California, there was like gecko, like there was lizards, like all of the. We lived in an apartment that had like the adobe kind of siding, like outside wall kind of thing. And whenever we'd walk outside, they would always be like all over the walls. And so sometimes they would get into the house. Can you imagine being in by the way, Santee, where we live, same climate as the Middle East, the same climate as Israel. And so you can imagine scenarios where there might be a lizard that climbs into your house somewhere or into your oven or whatever, and you end up accidentally touching one. So if that happens, then you got to wash your clothes and you're unclean until evening. So you can imagine how you might contact one of these by accident. And then verses 32 to 35 talks about items or food that can become unclean, like if you've got a pot or a vessel and how to clean them. If it's an earthenware vessel, then you've got to destroy it because it can kind of seep into the clay pot and stuff like that. But if it's like a spring or a cistern or dry seed that's not been watered yet, then it stays clean. So God's giving these different delineations between all of this. Verses 39 and 40 talk about clean animals that happen to die naturally. Like you come upon something, maybe somebody ran into the one with their camel, they were driving too fast, they didn't put the brakes on, and so it kills some clean animal or something. Or you were swinging your axe in the field and you accidentally hit Mr. Lamb next to you. What if that happens? You're unclean if you touch the dead, yet clean animal. If you happen upon one like that, if you eat or carry the carcass, you have to wash your clothes until evening. So that one you kind of give some license to, that you can eat that one, but you are going to be unclean. All right, so that's the instructions for how to become clean. Any comments or questions up through verse 40? Yeah, Everett?
When would be evening? Like when it's dark?
Evening is at 6. So have you ever noticed in Genesis, I'm just going to leave this up here for a second. This is just a chart of everything we just talked about. Have you ever noticed that in Genesis chapter 1, the text doesn't begin by saying there was morning and then there was evening. How does it start? There was evening and then there was morning. Why? It was dark first, and then God created the light. So, for the Jewish people, the way that they counted their time was that evening started at sundown, at 6 p.m. And so, then they had the four watches during the night and everything. But this is a chart, everything that we just talked about. You got the edible animals, the inedible animals, the land, water, sky, and there's other ways of dividing some of these things up. That chart is not totally comprehensive. But that's in the notes for anybody that wants them afterwards, which will be up here. Yeah?
Is there a they not be unclean all the time? Because if they were allowed to eat this animal and they killed it to eat it, then it's a carcass. Wouldn't that make them unclean?
For the, you're talking back in like 39 and 40?
Yeah.
So in 39 and 40 would be, let's go ahead and read that, because it's not talking about one that you intended to slaughter for eating, but you happen to have the opportunity to eat it. Look at verses 39 and 40. And if any animal which you may eat dies, which you may eat, so these are clean animals, whoever touches its carcass shall be unclean until the evening, and whoever eats of its carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening, and whoever carries the carcass shall wash his clothes and be unclean until the evening. All right, how do we know that that's talking about happening upon some that died accidentally or whatever? Well, because if they're making all these offerings at the tabernacle where they're touching the carcasses of clean animals, but they're not unclean in that scenario, this would be talking about coming upon a lamb or a sheep or something that died, and you're like, well, we can't let this thing go to waste. Let's go ahead. We're going to be unclean, but let's go ahead and do this, you know.
Probably, too, because when they slaughter it, they have to let the blood out.
Right. Yeah, but yeah, you're letting the blood out, so it's more of a ritual process that, that kind of keeps you from being impure in that. Jamie?
Wouldn't this be talking about an animal that they came upon that had been sick and just died?
Maybe.
You know, and that's why they're not supposed to touch it or eat it?
Well, you can eat it, though. Whoever eats of it, because it's not sinful to be okay. Impure. So I think it's giving license. You can eat this one. Let's say that you swung your axe and you accidentally killed the sheep or the lamb that was right next to you or something. Whatever the scenario could be, can you go ahead and make the best use of that and eat it? But you're going to be, yeah, I think that's the idea. So, okay. Alright, so the concluding summary of this chapter, you've got, let's go ahead and read this, and then we'll ask the question, why are these laws given? Look at verses 41 to 47. Every swarming thing that swarms on the ground is detestable. It shall not be eaten. Whatever goes on its belly and whatever goes on all fours, whatever has many feet, like the centipede, any that bite when that thing bit me, it's just stung in my mind. Like, it's just always there, so I always think about those. Any swarming thing that swarms on the ground you shall not eat, for they are detestable. You shall not make yourself detestable with any swarming thing that swarms, and you shall not defile yourselves with them and become unclean through them. For I am the Lord your God. Consecrate yourselves therefore and be holy, for I am holy. You shall not defile yourselves with any swarming thing that crawls on the ground. For I am the Lord who brought you up out of the land of Egypt to be your God. You shall therefore be holy, for I am holy. This is the law about the beast and the bird and every living creature that moves through the waters and every creature that swarms on the ground, to make distinction between the unclean and the clean, and between the living creature that may be eaten and the living creature that may not be eaten. Okay, so you get a restatement of some of the things that are unclean. You get some new details here. For example, whatever goes on its belly, although with the criteria given earlier, you'd kind of know that that's wrong. But what animal notoriously goes on its belly? The snakes, serpents. That kind of reminds you a little bit of Genesis 3, that the snake in the Bible is oftentimes pictured in a negative kind of way. But notice in verse 43, what happens to you if you eat something that's detestable?
You become detestable.
You become detestable. That's a really important phrase here. You are what you eat is the idea. That if you eat something detestable, you become detestable. Now, last night I just finished the book Knowing God by J.I. Packer. And this, when I was reading this, I just really liked this quote. He said this in his book. Do you spend as much time with the Bible each day as you do even with the newspaper? What fools some of us are. The idea that we're feeding off of all kinds of things that are just garbage. And he says, we're fools. When we've got the God of the universe that's given us his word, why are we feeding on things that are detestable? And then what happens to us when we feed on such things? We become detestable. We fight the same wars that the world fights, and we fight it the same way that the world fights it and stuff. So I like that phrasing in verse 43. So you've got this restatement there, and then he gives them this call to be holy. Now, the call to be holy, he tells them to consecrate themselves, which is the verb form of the word holy. And so you've got the word holy, like words that are related to it, used like three times in this text. What does it mean to be holy?
Set apart.
Set apart, it means that you're different. Where's the first time in the Bible that we read the word holy? Yes, Genesis chapter 2. So, day one of creation. Does God do something? Yeah, he creates things. So the first day of creation, he does one act of creation. The second day of creation, he does one act of creation. The third day, he does two acts. And then on the next day, it's one act, two acts. So he goes 1-1-2, 1-1-2. But every day, he's creating something in Genesis chapter 1. So if you were to line up all the days, the first 6 days of creation, you see action happening. And then the seventh day is totally different from all the others. That's the picture of holiness. That when you line yourself up to the rest of the world, to people that are living in the world, not following the Lord, is there something noticeably different about you? And it's not like an aggravating kind of like, I just want to be different, so I'm just going to be weird or whatever. No, it's like actually that I'm conforming myself to God, and that's why I'm different. So that's the first time that you see that word used. And these laws are supposed to make Israel different. Now, what's the basis of them being holy? Yeah, their relationship with God. God is holy, so you should be holy as God is holy. If he's our Father, shouldn't there be a family resemblance? And the fatherhood of God is not something talked about a lot in the Old Testament, but we know, yeah, Janice?
And can't you say, too, keeping yourself clean because God is perfectly clean?
That's right. Yeah. Yeah, holiness wrapped up in all of that. Were you going to say something, Jenna? No. All right. Also, God's grace is a motivator for this holiness because he says in verse 45 that I brought you up out of the land of Egypt. God's grace is used as a motivator for so many instructions in the Bible. In fact, what's the context of the Ten Commandments? He delivered them, and then he says, now this is what I have to tell you. The Old Testament law was not just like, work really hard and maybe you can save yourself. So many of the laws were embedded in the context of God's grace. So you got that going on there, and then they're supposed to make all these distinctions. Okay, so that's what chapter 11 is teaching. Now let's ask the question, what are some possible reasons for these food laws? I've got five possible reasons, and I favor the last one. But here are some ones that I don't like. The first one is that these laws were given out of health or hygiene concerns. Maybe there's something to that, but I've heard people say something like this, that the unclean animals were more dangerous to eat because you could get trichinosis, whatever. If you don't cook a lamb right or any other clean animal, could you possibly die from that too? Any problems with this view?
Well,
yeah, bacon is really good.
Later, he makes them clean. And
yeah, in the New Testament, he makes them all clean. So it's like you're saying then that in the Old Testament, God really cared about health. But in the New Testament, we can have clogged arteries, whatever we want. It doesn't matter. So I don't like that explanation. Here's another explanation, is the false religion explanation. And this is where people would say, well, the unclean animals were used in pagan rituals, and God is reacting to that, which, by the way, he does quite a bit in Leviticus. And so because those animals were used in pagan rituals, like the pigs, the Israelites are not going to use those same animals for rituals. Any problems with that? Do you know what other animals were also used by the pagans?
The same ones.
Yeah. Most notably, the cattle, the sheep, the goats. So that explanation doesn't work either. Here's a third one. The symbolic moral explanation. And this is where somebody would say, well, the unclean animals have similarities to things that are immoral. Like the predatory birds, for example. Like, there's just something about those unclean animals that's just like especially ugly in the way that they treat other animals. And so symbolically, they kind of seem to represent sinful things. What's wrong with that explanation?
Aren't humans the same thing?
What was that?
Aren't humans the same thing? We're predators.
Okay.
The good reason not to eat a human.
Yeah, good reason not to eat a human.
Every one of those really carries your mind away from God's true purpose, which was the spiritual one.
Yeah, God's purpose here is a spiritual one.
Yeah.
Teresa? No, you... what are some of the clean animals?
Cow.
Okay, cow.
Sheep.
Sheep. Do sheep ever fight each other?
Yeah.
Yeah, like, come on. Like, you can find problems with every animal doing animal-like things. The New Testament categorizes false teachers and sinful people as just straight-up animals. Okay, so any kind of animal. So it's not like some animals are just inherently more noble than other ones. And are unclean animals ever pictured in positive light in the Old Testament?
Yeah.
Like when?
Donkey.
Yeah, Balaam's donkey, good donkey. What about Exodus 19 when God says, I've delivered you on what? Eagle's wings in Exodus chapter 19 verse 4. God pictures himself as an unclean animal in Exodus 19. So you can't say that there's like this inherent like good and evil thing seen in some of these animals. So I don't like that one either. Another one is the modern anthropology explanation where people would say that the unclean animals don't express a certain kind of norm. That when you look at the unclean animals, they kind of seem to be like all over the place with their different categories. They're not following a certain kind of pattern that would make them clean otherwise. You do see patterns that God is giving here, but that's really difficult to apply to the birds because you've got the predatory birds, but then you've got the ostrich listed in 13 through 19. So those explanations don't work either. Anybody have another explanation? I'm about to put the one that I like on here, so maybe after I've set it up this way, you don't want to take a guess. So I'll just go ahead and put mine up there. I think that these laws made them avoid table fellowship with the Canaanites. I think this is the best explanation for it. That in 11, 46, and 47, they're supposed to make distinctions between these things. Obviously, like what was said, that these things are teaching the people to make distinctions about all kinds of things. But one of the ways that this would particularly apply is for the Gentiles that they were going to be living in the Promised Land with. Now, you see how this fits the context. Go over to Leviticus chapter 20. Look in Leviticus chapter 20, verses 22 to 26. And here he's talking a lot about not being like the pagans, not being like the people in the Promised Land, stuff like this. Look at this text. You shall therefore keep all my statutes and all my rules and do them, that the land where I am bringing you to live may not vomit you out. I love that imagery. And you shall not walk in the customs of the nations that I am driving out before you, for they did all these things, and therefore I detested them. But I have said, you shall inherit their land, and I will give it to you to possess, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God, who has separated you from the people. Okay, so in verse 24, he separated you from the people, right? Look at verse 25. You shall therefore separate the clean beast from the unclean, and the unclean bird from the clean. You shall not make yourselves detestable by beast or by bird or by anything with which the ground crawls, which I have set apart for you to hold unclean. You shall be holy to me, for I am the Lord, am holy, and have separated you from the people that you should be mine. So he's talking about the clean and unclean foods here in the context of being separated from the people. Now, apply that to Acts chapters 10 and 11 when Peter goes to whose house?
Cornelius.
And he has this sheep get dropped down in front of him three times with these unclean animals. And what does Jesus say to him three times? Rise, Peter, kill and eat. He says, I've never touched anything unclean. I've never eaten anything unclean, never touched my mouth. And then after he goes to Cornelius' household and he preaches to him, in Acts chapter 11, verses 1 through 3, the people from the circumcision party come to him and they criticize Peter for having done what? Eating with Gentiles. What were the food laws functionally doing for the Israelites? Keeping them separate from these people that would have influenced them for wrong. You can imagine living in the Promised Land, and one of your pagan neighbors is like, hey, want to have a pig roast? And with a southern accent, I don't know why. And the Israelite goes, I'm sorry, I can't do that. Well, everything else is kosher. Yeah, I'm just sorry, I can't do that. Which means that you don't have... What does table fellowship represent in the ancient world? Covenants and relationship and things like that, which you're not supposed to enter into with the pagans. In fact, you're supposed to bring them into your fold. You're not supposed to become like them. And so these laws would have really created some very functional distinctions between the group, the people. So I think that's probably the best explanation for that. Any comments or questions on that? Sewell?
I thought that there is a distinction between what is sinful and what is righteous. And then there are some things that seem to symbolize what's unrighteous.
Yeah.
Those of us who are older will remember the little rabbit with the ear down, which kind of came to represent Hugh Hefner's empire.
Right.
And if you saw somebody wearing one of those, it said something about him.
Right.
Now, there's nothing immoral about that little rabbit.
Right.
But it suggested that you had some kind of sympathy
or affiliation
with that culture.
Right.
And so there's some things even now, and I've tried to think of some examples, but maybe we've gotten too much like the world. But there are some things that are not necessarily immoral within themselves.
But because of the cultural context.
But they suggest that you're a part of
a
culture that is actually anti-Christian.
Right. Yep, good. And I think that's a lot of the explanation for this. Now, is it also possible that we just... I think that Leviticus 20 passage really, to me, solidifies that view right here. That's what I have to say about that. Okay. Just really quick lessons from the food laws, then we'll get to the chapter that seems sexist in chapter 12, so we'll all be excited for that. So a couple lessons from this. God makes distinctions. Clean and unclean is binary. God has been binary all throughout the Bible. Male, female, day, night, land, sea. He, in Genesis 1, all throughout the place. That's what, he's always made these kinds of distinctions. Now, I know that there's moral gray situations. I acknowledge that. But throughout the Bible, God is very binary, which seems outdated right now. Also, God calls his priests to teach the differences between these binary things. The priests are supposed to explain, this is what's clean, this is what's not clean. What would that look like today? This is what a male is, this is what a female is. It's just ironic that we live in a society that praises science so much, but we can't seem to know the difference between those things. Also, God wants us holy in all aspects of life. When it comes to what you eat, God wants you to be holy here, but you think today about our entertainment, our clothing, our friendships. Are we being holy in every aspect of our life? Third quick lesson from this, food distinctions don't apply in the New Testament anymore. Romans 14, 1 Timothy 4, Acts 10, all of these passages show you that God's food laws have gone away under the New Covenant. So we're supposed to be thankful for everything we have, especially the pig. And in Acts 10 and 11, this shows us that table fellowship can be with anyone. That the food differences shouldn't be dividing God's people. Okay, so that's the food laws. Anything else you guys want to say about that? Yeah.
With the food rules gone, now they can spread the word.
That's right.
People.
That's right, and that's not a barrier to doing it anymore. I've seen this happen before, where Christians get so gung-ho about a particular diet. Like, I'm going to do the pre-flood diet, where I'm not eating any meat. Or I'm going to do the keto diet, where I'm only eating fat and meat. Or I'm going to do this diet or that diet. And I've seen it happen where it prevents Christians from being able to spend time with each other. Like, have meals together. It's pathetic and it's sad. And so, if you have your personal food preferences, that's fine. But don't let that come in the way of getting to know God's people. I know that there's gluten intolerance. I know that there's people that have got reasons for eating. Figure those things out, but don't divide over these issues. Yeah.
If they couldn't eat pigs, what would they do with them?
If they couldn't eat them, what would they do with them? Give them to the Canaanites, yeah.
But there was...
They didn't keep them. Like,
yeah, I don't think they kept them.
Yeah, they
would have not been around. Okay, let's talk about this other chapter here. We've got about 10 minutes. I think we can cover this in about 10 minutes. Look at chapter 12, verses 1 through 8. We'll read the whole chapter. It's very short. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel, saying, if a woman conceives and bears a male child, then she shall be unclean 7 days, as at the time of her menstruation she shall be unclean. And on the 8th day the flesh of his foreskin shall be circumcised. Then she shall continue for 33 days in the blood of her purifying. She shall not touch anything holy, nor come into the sanctuary until the days of her purifying are completed. But if she bears a female child, then she shall be unclean 2 weeks, as in her menstruation, and she shall continue in the blood of her purifying for 66 days. And when the days of her purifying are completed, whether for a son or for a daughter, she shall bring to the priest at the entrance of the tent of meeting a lamb 1 year old for a burnt offering, and a pigeon or a turtle dove for a sin offering. And he shall offer it before the Lord and make atonement for her. Then she shall be clean from the flow of her blood. This is the law for her who bears a child, either male or female. And if she cannot afford a lamb, then she shall take 2 turtle doves or 2 pigeons, one for the burnt offering and the other for the sin offering. And the priest shall make atonement for her, and she shall be clean." Okay. So let's. There's obvious questions that this chapter raises. But in verses 1 through 4, it talks about what a woman does if she gives birth to a son. Now, there's going to be 2 stages of uncleanness after giving birth to a son. Stage 1 is how many days?
7 days,
a full week. All right? And how is this period of 7 days compared? What is it compared to? It's the same kind of way that you deal with being unclean during your menstrual cycle. Okay, so what is that all about? You don't read about it until Leviticus 15. But in Leviticus 15, what you're going to see is that this stage is the most severe form of uncleanness, where your uncleanness is contagious. So in this stage of being unclean, if a woman sat on a couch or whatever, the couch would become unclean, it would have to be washed, all this kind of stuff. So it's contagious uncleanness for the first 7 days. Stage 2 is how many days of uncleanness?
33 days.
And the thing that's different about this is that it's non-contagious uncleanness. That if you make food for the kids or start shoveling something outside, I don't know, that the shovel doesn't become unclean, all that kind of thing. So it's non-contagious, but you still can't enter the tabernacle or touch the sacred things. So there's 2 stages. Okay. Now, you've got the son being circumcised on the 8th day. This is the only time in Leviticus you read about circumcision. Have you ever noticed how little Moses himself wrote about circumcision in the law portions? It's only mentioned 1 time in Leviticus, and in Deuteronomy when it's mentioned in reference to circumcising your heart. You don't have a lot in Leviticus and Deuteronomy, or Numbers on this. So you've got that given there. Okay. Now you've got the birth of the daughter. The 2 stages again, but what is stage 1? How many days for the birth of the daughter? 14 of contagious uncleanness, and then 66 days of non-contagious uncleanness. And so all of us would look at that and go, what's the question?
Why?
All right. Who knows? God must hate women, right? He's just proven that in so many parts of the Bible. I think circumcision has something to do with this.
The son has to be circumcised.
Yes. Do we know that male and female are made in God's image? That's how the Bible begins. Were you going to say something, Nenna?
Not that I agree, but the value of a male over a female at that time.
So maybe it has something to do with the it's a patriarchal society, especially, and so maybe the man gets less time of uncleanness or something like that. Maybe it has something to do with women are unclean more often than men, like with the menstrual cycles and stuff like this. You'll read about this in Leviticus 15. That maybe it's fitting that for a woman who's going to be unclean more often than a man, that the birth of a daughter, the uncleanness would last longer. Maybe it has something to do with the command to circumcise the men on the 8th day. And so it requires this non-contagious uncleanness to need to be done by day 7. So that on day 8, they can go and do that. I think it has something to do with that. But we know from how the Bible begins that it certainly has nothing to do with God valuing women less. By the way, the circumcision on the eighth day, anybody remember King David when he sins with Bathsheba and she gives birth to a son? Do anybody remember what day he dies on? The seventh day. The day right before he would have been circumcised. I've always wondered if David was kind of wondering, is he going to become a covenant Israelite? Okay, so that those are the, we'll say more about this in just a second. But any comments or questions up through verse 5? All right. So in 6 through 8, you've got the offerings that are supposed to be given. So in verses 6 through 8, what's the offering for the man, a male child, and what's the offering for a female child? Everett?
I have a question. Who would circumcise a kid?
Who what?
Who would circumcise a child?
Who would do the circumcision? I don't know if it would be the father of the family or the priests. I'm not sure on that, because I know Abraham circumcised his son, but I don't know.
Moses' wife circumcised her son.
Yeah, that's right. Moses' wife supported that in Exodus 4. So I'm not sure. All right, so what are the offerings given for the male and the female child? Okay. That's a trick question, by the way. It's the same thing. Whether it's a boy or a girl, it's the same offering, which fits within this context that women are not less valuable than men, but they bring a burnt offering, a lamb 1 year old, and then they bring a sin offering, a pigeon or a turtle dove. Now, is the sin offering because she sinned? What else does the sin offering accomplish? The same procedure. What was that? Nope. Nope.
Ordination.
Nope. No. So it's the same procedure as the sin offering, but the sin offering can subdivide. Sometimes it's because somebody sinned, and other times it's because somebody's impure. So some people call it the purification offering. And so I don't think that this offering is given so that she can be forgiven. It's so that in verse 7 she can be clean. And so some people look at this and go, well, what sin is there in giving birth to children? The first command to humans is to be fruitful and multiply. So how could God hold a woman accountable for getting pregnant? This is one of the passages that my mom is especially offended by. And when you understand what the purification offering is for, that it's used for multiple purposes, then you kind of see how that's going. All right, one thing to say about this. Some people have said that if you have to offer these sacrifices at the birth of a child, then that just proves that the children are born sinful. Who are these offerings for in the text? For the mother, not for the children. All right, so there's provisions for the poor. What if you couldn't afford a lamb, what could you bring? Two turtle doves or two pigeons. What is it that Jesus' family brought when Jesus was circumcised? Two turtle doves. That means that Jesus came from what kind of a family?
Poor.
A poor family. Luke shows us that. By the way, it's ironic that when they bring Jesus to be circumcised, they also do bring the lamb, because Jesus would later become the Lamb of God. So that's maybe an interesting thing that happens. But notice that in verse 8, it says that if they cannot afford a lamb, what does that imply maybe they did at times with their sacrifices? You can't afford it. Is it like you look at your pasture land and you just can't afford to give one up? Or is it sometimes that people would actually purchase their sacrifice, the sacrifices? Like they did in the New Testament, in the Gospels, where they would go and buy the animals. Like, who's going to travel 800 miles and keep an animal unblemished? It seems like the Old Testament law gave provision for actually purchasing the animal somewhere. And so what the problem was when Jesus cleansed the temple was not inherently, it wasn't inherently wrong to be buying your sacrificial animal. But there was other problems going on, like overcharging or putting it in the wrong place, stuff like that. Those are maybe some things to consider. Okay, so here's one question. Here's the big question for this. Why does childbirth cause uncleanness? Everett?
Well, isn't there a bodily discharge right before birth?
Yes. Well, kind of. I mean, the baby comes out and there's a lot of blood. When Samantha gave birth in the little pool thing that we had in our house, There's lots of blood in there. Yeah, Morgan?
Was that part of the curse that God put on child?
That she would be unclean, or the pain in childbearing? Yeah, I think, by the way, there's a couple things to say about this. This is a slight tangent. When it says that there'll be pain in childbearing, does that imply that Eve, prior to that curse, had been bearing children? I think so. Because now you know what it would be like. You knew what it was like to bear kids without this pain that I'm talking about. And now you're going to experience what it's like to have pain in childbirth. So I think Cain and Abel, they're the first two that we read about, but I think Adam and Eve had already been having kids. But God promises that there's going to be pain in childbearing. That's not just the act of giving birth. In Genesis, what's the next story in Genesis? Cain killing Abel. Do you think one of the pain of childbearing is siblings not always getting along? Is sibling rivalry, family feuds a problem in Genesis? Yeah, what about kids that you just read through Genesis and how they treated Joseph? All of that's part of the chain of the pain of childbearing. But that's a tangent. Yeah, Janice?
Well, the thought is with me. I don't know if it's exactly with what you're just saying right now, but had God told them to be fruitful and multiply and to populate the earth, which would have been have children? I mean, it was a command of God.
Right.
In the beginning. So having children in and of itself would not be a sin.
Right.
Because God did not command sin.
Right. And so there's something about, like, and this is, again, why it's important to know uncleanness is not sinful. It just means you can't go to the temple right now. Do you suppose that it would have been kind of nice for the mom to not be able to go out after giving birth? I mean, I don't know how Samantha did it, but 8 days after Asher was born, we went on a 3-mile hike in California, and 12 hours after Abigail was born, we were at a Starbucks, like the Starbucks we always went to in Santee. I don't know how Samantha does that, but I understand that for most women, they would sure like to just not have to do anything for a while. Maybe these laws, when you actually look at what they're saying, I'm like, well, that sure be pretty convenient that I have to stay home right now. But maybe there's something else going on here. The fertility cults in the ancient world, where sex and child sacrifice were a common part of the false worship, how old were kids when they would make them as sacrificial offerings, and where would they do them? Like worshiping Molech, up to 5-year-olds. So that means everything under 5. Could that mean like a mom gives birth and she's really, you know, she really feels compelled that I have to go bring my 2-day-old son to Molech? So that when you've got this idea of the children being born, this uncleanness where God's saying, you do not go to the tabernacle. You cannot go for 40 days if it's a male, or 80 days if it's a girl. You do not do anything in association with the altar after you've given birth. Unlike the pagans who would have been eager to go bring their child to an altar to sacrifice. And so I think part of this, and this is where, when we see the things about in chapter 15 about the bodily discharges, that for the menstrual period or for if a man has a bodily discharge while he's sleeping, which implies that he's not doing that by himself. He has to wait for his body to naturally do it while he's sleeping. Those things do not allow you to go to the tabernacle, which is wildly different than the fertility cults where sex was part of the worship. And so you see these laws in that context where God has been saying, you need to be separate, you need to be separate. God is not being sexist. I think he's protecting the children and maybe giving special protection to the women, the daughters, who may have been more easily sacrificed in that culture. The men were not going to be the ones sacrificed as much, I wouldn't imagine. But I haven't read any research on that part, which gender was more often sacrificed. But I look at this as protection for the daughters and for the sons more than anything. And for the mom. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, he's encouraging the women to stay at home and bond with their babies.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, your hormones go crazy after you have babies. Sometimes you're not in your right mind, you know?
Right.
And that would give you time to just kind of even out a little bit.
Yeah. I see this as being very kind on God's part. Janice?
Just as an overall thing, the difference between that is made in this commandment of God, it definitely shows that God made a distinction between men and women.
Yes, there's a distinction.
For our culture today, I mean, you can't deny that there's a real difference in what God had to say in so many places. But
right.
I think this underlines it too.
Right. I was talking to some people recently about feminism. The classic form of feminism that says, can we have equal pay, at least, that's, I'm fine with that. But the modern form, where it's really about supremacy, whatever that even means.
Leadership was given by God, but, you know, to men, obviously.
Right, right. But one of the things that I told somebody that I was talking to, who is the more extreme modern kind of feminist, is I said that there's differences between men and women, and at the end of the day, Samantha will always be better at breastfeeding the kids. And, like, biology teaches us that there's a difference. And it doesn't mean that one is valued more than the other, but the extreme feminist movement, I think, is doing so much damage in the minds of how we understand gender roles and how much we're devaluing raising children, like, giving life to kids. Like, why is that not a good thing? More to come on that later. All right, any final comments? We're already going past time here. All right, well, thanks for your guys' interest. Sorry that we've gone past a couple times now. But Lord willing, in 2 weeks, we'll look at the leprosy laws, and we'll look at the bodily discharge instructions about cleanness and uncleanness. I hope that studying through this, you're seeing things that you hadn't seen before, and that this is beneficial to us in some ways. Let's go ahead and pray, and then we'll be done for this morning. Gracious Father, we love you, and we thank you so much for your Son. We thank you for Him coming into this world, for Him being born, and for Him experiencing the difficulties that the human body brings to people. We thank you so much for the example that we have in Him. We thank you for all the laws that you've given to us that help us know how to be distinct from the world around us. We pray that we would indeed seek to be holy and to be different, that we would conform ourselves not to the world, but we would conform ourselves to you, so that we would be pleasing to you, even if that means that the world is not pleased with us. We love you for first loving us. We pray that you give us wisdom and strength, and it's in Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Oh yeah, just as a reminder, Deuteronomy, Chronicles, Jeremiah, or Luke is what I'm thinking. So if anybody's got a preference, let me know.